The Old Testament, the book of Ruth and chapter 4. There is no time stated at the beginning of chapter 4 when Boaz made his way to the town gate. But we imagine it was as early next morning as was seemly. Naomi was right when she said in the last verse of chapter 3 that the man would not rest until the matter of his kinsman was settled that very day. Because we remember the charm of this girl who served in his harvest field, and how gracefully he dealt with her. We have been enchanted with this beautiful book after all the horrors that we have read of toward the end of the book of Judges. So when Boaz's kinsman appeared at the city gate, the town gate, Boaz immediately engaged him in private conversation. As I said during the reading, we still do not know the man's name. He turns out to be of really passing significance, although his decision is all important to Boaz and to Ruth and her mother-in-law. Then Boaz gathered 10 elders of the town and made them sit together with him and his kinsmen in conference. How would you have arranged it if you had been in Boaz's place? Then he set out the facts to his kinsmen. Everything above board, so unlike modern intrigues. Naomi, he said, is selling the piece of land which had belonged to her husband Elimelech when they left for Moab during the famine. She was naturally now in need of money, and since there were laws concerning the transfer of land from one to another, it was right that he, this kinsman, this nameless kinsman, as nearest of kin to the deceased, should have first opportunity of purchase, to keep it as near as possible in the family and clan, according to the law of God for Israel. For, of course, the land was his, and it was lent to the Israelites, and they had no right to give it away. Boaz thought the man should know of Naomi's intention to sell the land, and that it should be declared in the presence of representative elders of the town. If the kinsman wanted to buy the land, since as nearest kin to Elimelech he had the prior right of redemption, he should declare it. You'll see, if you care to turn up an example of this sort of thing, in Jeremiah 32:6. A few verses there. Jeremiah 32:6. Jeremiah said, The word of the Lord came to me, Hanamel, son of Shallum, your uncle is going to come to you and say, buy my field at Anathoth, which was Jeremiah's birthplace, because as nearest relative it is your right and duty to buy it. Then, just as the Lord had said, my cousin Hanamel came to me in the courtyard of the guard and said, buy my field at Anathoth in the territory of Benjamin. Since it is your right to redeem it and possess it, buy it for yourself. I knew, says Jeremiah, that this was the word of the Lord. So I bought, thinking, of course, of the captivity that was soon to take place when the Jews would be scattered and ultimately he would be banished to Egypt. So I bought the field at Anathoth from my cousin Hanamel and weighed out for him 17 shekels of silver. I signed and sealed the deed, had it witnessed, and weighed out the silver on the scale. I took the deed of purchase, the sealed copy containing the terms and conditions as well as the unsealed copy, and I gave this deed to Baruch, son of Neriah, the son of Maaseiah, that is, Jeremiah's secretary, in the presence of my cousin Hanamel and of the witnesses who had signed the deed, and of all the Jews, notice, sitting, almost a public occasion, sitting in the courtyard of the guard. So, having declared to the kinsman redeemer what the situation was, Boaz ended by saying, and I, said he significantly, indicating surely to some extent his interest, and I am next in line to you. But you see, there's a prior difficulty here before we go on. If you look at the book of Numbers and the 27th chapter and the 8th verse concerning the inheritance of the daughters of Zelophehad, you see that a son or daughter or brother or nearest relative in the clan, presumably male, can inherit property. But it doesn't mention widow. These are the words, Numbers 27 and 8. Say to the Israelites, if a man dies and leaves no son, give his inheritance over to his daughter. If he has no daughter, give his inheritance to his brothers. If he has no brothers, give his inheritance to his father's brothers. If his father had no brothers, give his inheritance to the nearest relative in his clan that he may possess it. This is to be a legal requirement for the Israelites, as the Lord commanded Moses. But there's no mention of a widow, which, as far as Naomi is concerned, has puzzled the scholars. Suffice it to say that in what was virtually a local court, no question apparently was asked of the right of Naomi to own her late husband's property. And Itch Rowley, the well-known Old Testament scholar of an earlier day, suggests that custom may have given a widow the right to to own property. Rowley even suggests that Elimelech may have willed it to Naomi, although, of course, there's no evidence for that. So said the kinsman redeemer, oh yes, apparently with alacrity, I will redeem it. As if to say, there's no reason why I shouldn't, since I have first claim. And although Boaz, by informing me of the fact, and by indicating that you are next of kin to Elimelech after me, you seem to show some interest in whether I redeem the property or not. I had better tell you right away, cousin, or whatever relationship you bear me, that I will redeem it. Sorry. But that's the position. That's how it stands. But the kinsman redeemer may have wondered why, at that rejoinder by Boaz didn't seem as crestfallen as he might have expected. Was there more to this than met the eye? Yes. On the day you redeem the land from Naomi, Boaz added, as part of the purchase of the land, there is included the acquisition, not the purchase, of course, but the acquiring of Ruth, the Moabitess, the widow of Elimelech's son, Mahlon. And he states the reason, in order to perpetuate the name of the dead. Silence. Sudden volte face. Complete turn around. Non-cooperation. Nothing doing, was the man's response to that. Notice, he didn't say he wouldn't, but that he couldn't. Now, it's not clear what he means by that, but he may be saying something like this. The purchase of this land, which would ultimately go to any son of Ruth's, and would therefore be no advantage to me, whereas the cost of maintaining another field, and the added burden of maintaining Ruth, might affect my ability to look after my own estate. What do you think his reason for his refusal? Possibly the vagueness indicates an excuse, which is not unconnected with the thought that the acquisition of a wife he may not have wanted, whether because she was a Moabitess, a foreigner, although there's no hint of that, or because he was perfectly satisfied with his own wife, which of course was the very best of reasons, wasn't it? Indicated clearly that the bargain was not on. But he might have given his reason. We're inquisitive creatures when we read the Bible. Too inquisitive sometimes. He might have given the reason, if the reason was anything like we have suggested. So the kinsman immediately said to Boaz, buy it yourself. So he took off his sandal which apparently was such an ancient custom that the writer had to explain it at verse 7. And presumably he handed the shoe to Boaz. But notice what is transferred by that symbolic action. Not the property, for it was still Naomi's, but the right to redeem it. And so this staid bachelor of years, indeed, could contain himself no longer. We've seen hints in the earlier chapters of the story that staid though he was undoubtedly attracted to this charming girl of such gracious manners and consideration for others. He could contain himself no longer. What a speech he makes before this court of the elders. Look at it, verses 9 and 10. Today, he says, he announces to the elders and all the people, there seems to have been a crowd, today you are witnesses, and of course he was a very prominent man in the town of Bethlehem. Today you are witnesses that I have bought from Naomi all the property of Elimelech, Chilion, and Mahlon. I have also acquired Ruth, Moabitess, Mahlon's widow, as my wife, in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property, so that his name will not disappear from among his family or from the town records. Today, you are witnesses. Now, throughout these chapters, we have seen a number of the qualities of this man Boaz. And, you know, marveling at his ancestry, the sordidness of it on his father's side. The story in Judah in Genesis chapter 38. And the sordidness of his ancestry on his mother's side. Rahab, the harlot, although she was undoubtedly a transformed woman before Salmon, the prince of Judah, married her. Despite the background and origins, we see further than the qualities of grace which flowed so naturally from this dear man in testing circumstances. He is also thoroughly acquaint with the law and the customs, and knows how to set up a local court, how to conduct it, and what to say in the hearing of witnesses, with full corroboration of what has been transacted, so that anything as important as a marriage contract should be right in every detail, especially as it involved the delicate relationship of a goel, a kinsman redeemer. And of course, there were two kinsmen redeemers there, himself and the other man. And it was all conducted with such openness and quiet skill that the witnessing elders spontaneously exclaimed at the happiness of the outcome. The whole town seems delighted. This is the respect they have for this man. And apparently by that time for the girl. But you see, we also see the shrewdness of Boaz, how he presented the case to his kinsman as a matter of the redemption of a piece of land. And the other man, being apparently ignorant of the entail of a young widow of foreign nationality, Boaz kept that matter until the man had enthusiastically agreed to buy the land. And the fact that he was so ready to buy it, but not to be saddled with the acquisition of the young woman, causes us to ask, why did he choose the one but not the other? And it would appear that it was the upkeep of Ruth and the land, and the fact that the land would naturally go to any son he might beget by this Moabitess. That seems to be something of the reasons which swayed him completely against this added burden. We would also like to think he did not want such a marriage to complicate his own present life, which presumably included a wife he was happy with. It was different, of course, with Boaz. So the result is pleasing all round, with that beautiful completeness of neat detail, you see, which should mark transactions governed by the God of grace, which is more than interesting, you know, to us now, since we as a congregation, and particularly as a deacon's court with its officials, are engaged in some of the most delicate and complicated machinery of business transaction that most of us have ever been witness to. The huge sums involved, and the rules in particular which the Historic Building Society apply with regard to the verification of the work done properly before they release the full amount of the 80% agreed to in the contract. That has involved us not only in cash flow problems, but in greater expenditure than we had at first bargained for. In the circumstances, I think that if those in the congregation, especially those interested in these long drawn out negotiations, had been present at recent deacon's court meetings, they would have marveled not only at the know-how and expertise of our congregational representatives, something which often astonishes me in other directions than the spire, when particular skills are called for which the rest of us do not possess. The supply of skills, you see, is one of God's richest gifts to us in these days, which makes life among us so exciting and pleasing and satisfying. That's one reason, if I may put in this, why we mourn the deep sickness of dear Rosemary Cattenor. What a worker she has been here for more than 40 years. And what losses we have sustained in recent years by such workers who have labored for God for decades, and the Lord has been pleased to remove from us long before old age. Our praise to God these days, you know, should really exceed. I sometimes think that we are aware of that when we are singing praise. And we would need ever more ecstatic anthems to sing to our God, who does all things so supremely well. But, as I am saying, there is not only the expertise at hand, but the prevailing grace and good humor with which these negotiations are conducted, even to the end of taxing meetings. Our cup truly overflows. And when we think of what we owe to the great hinterland of our absent congregation and adherents at home and abroad, for a flow of money with abundant expressions of goodwill and promises of prayers, it sometimes seems to me that we need to say to the Lord, "Oh, stop the flow of your gracious acts towards us, Lord, for a little, until we take them in sufficiently to thank you adequately for your amazing grace." Which is precisely what Boaz must have been feeling that day as he left the town gate to ponder the fact that he had not only bought for himself a new piece of land, but what very likely had been the desire of his heart from his youth, a beautiful and gracious wife. I wonder, you know, if on looking back, he saw why the Lord had withheld a wife from him until he was a man of some maturity. Until that moment, when all his contemporaries and associates were doubtless long since married and rearing their families. But then you see, it is often that only with hindsight we see why the good Lord withholds the blessings we think we ought to have enjoyed earlier, and have sometimes strained our relationships with our very Lord and Master, alas, been out of sorts with the Lord, because we have dared to disagree with him on what we have regarded as his parsimony to us, in not providing all the blessings we sought and felt we had a right to. But he knows best. But it often takes us a long, long time to see that. The pleasure of the elders and all others who had listened to this fascinating open-air court procedure, the pleasure is apparent. Perhaps What is recorded at verses 11 and 12 of chapter 4 is the speech of one of the men who assumed a leadership among the witnesses. Verses 11 and 12. Then the elders and all those at the gate said, I think there must have been a spokesman. It wasn't a chorus, was it? We are witnesses, perhaps it was. We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your home like Rachel. Rachel's tomb was just a mile or two away at Ephratah, the outskirt of Bethlehem. Your home like Rachel and Leah. Notice the order, please. Notice the order. Not the elder, Leah first, but Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel and provided those 12 sons to Israel. May you have standing in Ephratah and be famous in Bethlehem. Through the offspring the Lord gives you by this young woman, may your family be like that of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah. The reference to Rachel and Leah, and you, as I say, you notice the order, is exceedingly gracious, you know, in view of the foreign nationality of the bride. Indeed, these Jews, I mean, in these early days you would call them Judahites, but later to be called Jews, of course. These Jews are not afraid to refer right back to the unsavory origins of the clan of Judah, with Perez, the twin son of an incestuous union of Judah with his own daughter-in-law, Tamar, upon the disgraceful occasion, you remember, of Judah's adulterous involvement with what appears to have been a wayside prostitute. Genesis 38, a chapter that some people avoid. All this, you see, is simply rehearsed as history, with the obvious implication that God had overruled all the sordidness of their origins to make the tribe of Judah and its clan exceedingly illustrious. A luster which did not disdain unsavory elements in it. And we've applied that to our Lord, who was made to become sin for us. And you see, this should teach us something very particular, very important. I think applying this lesson, I think of the young man who fell in love at first sight with a beautiful young lady from afar, but was devastated to learn subsequently that she had already had an affair with another married man. It broke his heart because he so desired a pure virgin for his bride. What would he do? It had to be pointed out to him kindly, graciously, patiently, that while he had not sinned in that area himself, and earnestly sought a bride who was equally pure. Perhaps the Lord was simply showing him that since we are all sinners in many particulars, it was important that forgiveness in that area was just as important as in other areas, which may not seem so unsavory. But perhaps, in God's eyes, more heinous. That, I can tell you, is one of the happiest marriages I know. We can be so selective with regard to our censoriousness of sinners. How lenient we can be with others guilty of our particular besetments. And yet, of course, strangely enough, because there's nothing so strange in the world as human nature, it can work the other way too, that we are often most condemnatory of those whose sins are precisely our besetments. And perhaps it is conscience which makes us rebel about our own sins in other people. But we mustn't dwell in this happy chapter on these unhappy things to the detriment of our rejoicing, along with the populace of Bethlehem, that perhaps their most illustrious citizen had at last found for himself a bride and a wife. And when a son is born to Boaz and Ruth, the rejoicing again exceeded, as the women of the town hurried to Naomi to share her rejoicing that a kinsman redeemer had been born to one who had been so sorely bereft of both husband and two sons. The women seem to have been given a prophetic note to their rejoicings. For little did they know, perhaps surely by divine intimation, how famous the grandson of this child, Obed, would be, even David, the psalmist and king of Judah and Israel. Wonderful. All's well. Not that ends well, Shakespeare. That's all right. That's all right. But all's well that continues well. For despite all the calamity and the disaster which increasingly overtakes our life on this planet. Since Paul reminds Timothy that evil will wax worse and worse as the day of the Lord's coming approaches. I say, despite all the calamity and the disaster which increasingly overtakes our life on this planet, and sometimes our pastors and ministers know more about that than many, dear Jim Dick, the lavishness of the Lord's goodness to his children who go his way and seek to advance his will and his purpose for the growth of his church and the coming of his kingdom. The lavishness, I say, of the Lord's goodness is just such a constant amazement as should call forth ever greater praise from us. And as I ended my notes on this beautiful subject, this wonderful chapter, I thought to myself, there is only one anthem, I think, that we could sing after that, and it is the one that we call our anthem and have sung every year for it must be 20 or 30 or more years at our annual business meeting, hymn number 22, Praise to the Lord, the Almighty, the King of creation. O my soul, praise him, for he is thy health and salvation. 22.